George Orwell once said, "In a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act." That said, welcome to Our Hen House, a new podcast in which we try to tell some truths about animals and our changing relationships with them, especially, but not exclusively, farmed animals. Each episode will cover trends, news, some personal ramblings, and interviews with some of the grooviest activists, changemakers, truth-tellers, and just plain Janes who have something to say. My name is Jasmine Singer, and I'll be your co-host here in Our Hen House, along with my trusty partner in life and partner in activism, Marianne Sullivan. In today's podcast, we'll be talking about how we personally got involved with animal issues. Then we'll go over some of the major events in 2009 for farmed animals. We will talk to longtime activist Stuart David all about the locavore movement. And finally, we will be letting you in on our opinions about the newest fake meats on the market, Match Meat and Gardein. So please, pull up some hay. Let's get squawking. Please welcome my co-host, Marianne Sullivan.
Hi, Jasmine.
Hi, sweetie. This is our very first podcast.
Yeah, it's been an exciting experience trying to figure out how to do this.
I'm sensing a tad bit of sarcasm. That wasn't even a sound effect. That was actually Marianne. So, Marianne, I was thinking that we should probably use this section to talk about ourselves just a little bit and be a little narcissistic. What do you think?
I'm sure people are dying to hear about us.
Well, you never know. Why don't we start with you? So, why are you here today? What brings you to Our Hen House?
Well, I live here.
Right, there's that.
And the reason we're doing a podcast is because we're both very interested in animal issues. And the way I first got interested in animal issues, I think, was a dog. My beloved Calhoun, a dog I loved so much. And in living with him, I started to realize that animals had more going on than I had previously thought. And I just started to think about animals. And as so many of us in this community know, one thing just led to another. And I became interested in farm animal issues in particular, and I met David Wolfson, who I ended up, a brilliant farm animal lawyer, who I ended up writing some articles with.
Actually, let me interrupt you. You're a brilliant farm animal lawyer yourself.
Oh, sweetie.
Yeah, but you are. You're a lawyer, and you teach animal law. Where do you teach animal law?
I teach animal law at Cardozo Law School and Brooklyn Law School, and I also have a regular job, which doesn't have anything to do with animals at all.
But it has to do with law.
Yeah, and it makes me lots of money.
Lots and lots of money.
Yeah, not that very much money.
But let's see. So you are you teach animal law, and you are the vice chair? Is that what they call it?
I'm the chair-elect of the American Bar Association Tort Trial and Insurance Practice Section's Animal Law Committee, which is the primary animal, well, the only animal law committee in the ABA, and I'm going to be chair next year. I'm very excited about that. That committee is really doing some exciting work.
Do they give you extra vegan brownie points if you can actually pronounce it in one breath?
Yeah, it is kind of a mouthful.
But it is also really a huge honor. And as you said, you've written articles with David and you've spoken at various conferences. And I personally think you're a very smart lady.
Oh, Jasmine, you're my biggest fan. How did you end up in this crazy, crazy business, Jasmine?
Let's see. I came into animal rights by way of AIDS awareness. I was an activist for a theater company because my background is actually in theater. And my first job out of college was as an actor educator for an AIDS awareness organization called Night Star. And I had already been a vegetarian for many years. And at that time, I met a vegan and I thought she was radical and crazy. And then, poof, I became one too. And I guess because I was already an activist, activism came naturally to me. And at that point, I started doing workshops
actually, funnily enough, with Marisa Miller Wolfson, David Wolfson's partner. And we started doing workshops around town, and that got bigger, and I started doing them at various conferences and things. And meanwhile, I was also writing. I'm the current campaigns manager for Farm Sanctuary, an organization near and dear to my heart. However, this podcast does not have to do with Farm Sanctuary, and my opinions and your opinions are not necessarily those of Farm Sanctuaries. I am a writer. I have a few blogs.
And an excellent writer, I might add.
Oh, sweetheart, you're my biggest fan. At least if no one else listens to our hen house, we will.
And I'm subscribing tomorrow.
Me too. And so is Rose, our dog. We forgot to mention Rose.
I don't know how. She's sitting right here.
We have the most beautiful, wonderful pit bull in the entire world, and I love her madly. And everyone who meets her loves her madly. So anyway, yada, 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 that's who we are, and that's how we got involved in this. And our resolution, or let me say my resolution for the new year, was to have a podcast. And since you were in the same room as me, you were awarded the opportunity to podcast with me. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's exciting. I wouldn't be doing this without my very modern girlfriend dragging me into the future. But it's kind of fun, I think.
And it was kind of your fault for getting a Mac for Hanukkah for me.
Yeah.
So anyway, honey, while you were looking at the quotes for me to read at the beginning, you found this quote.
And isn't that quote that we do start off with? I just love that quote.
The George Orwell one.
Right. It's so true. This is a time. This is certainly a time of universal deceit about animals. Mm-hmm. Nobody is telling the truth, and everybody is keeping it secret. And I think if we were to tell the truth and actually get the truth out there, it would create a revolutionary change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think that the trend is shifting, and it is an exciting time to be involved right now. It can't not collapse. The industry can't not collapse.
It's really true. It's exists only because it is completely secret, and yet it is a secret with 10 billion creatures being hidden from our view. At some point, people's eyes have got to be opened, and when they are, they'll be horrified. Well, not everybody will be horrified, as we know. We all have run into people who aren't, but enough people will be horrified once they get out of the complicity that exists now in everybody's mind keeping the secret and other people not wanting to know. Once that ends, yeah, I think this industry is coming down.
So when you were looking for quotes and you found that one, you came across another one that I just totally love, and I'm going to read it now. If a rabbit defined intelligence the way man does, then the most intelligent animal would be a rabbit, followed by the animal most willing to obey the commands of a rabbit. And that was said by Robert Brault. I have no idea who you are, Robert Brault, but your website is robertbrault.com, and I like your quote.
Yeah, I think that's pretty funny. We are a very arrogant species, aren't we?
Yeah, it's you know, I remember when I first learned about animal issues, I thought, how can I not do something, and how could I not have known?
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty easy not to know, because they do make a lot of effort to keep it a secret. But at the same time, we do know that a lot of people find out, or could easily find out, and they still don't do anything. I mean, look at the people walking around wearing fur. Do they really not know? Do they really not have any idea that there might be a problem here? I mean, the fact is that a lot of people just suck.
People do suck. That's true. Let's just go right on.
No, we're not supposed to say that. We're supposed to be good people. We're animal advocates. Yes, we care about people too. We do.
Well, that being said, Marianne, I have to say that I've been listening to a book on tape by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn called Half the Sky.
Oh, yeah, I have to read that book.
You absolutely do, or listen to it. And it's talking about women's oppression and sex trafficking in other in third world countries. And of course, sex trafficking and women's oppression is going on right here in the United States also. But this book is particularly focusing on quote unquote developing countries. And
it had a similar effect on me, I gotta tell you, to when I learned about animal issues. I just thought, how could I not have known to the full extent of what was going on? How can I not get involved? And my third conclusion was a reaffirmation of the fact that people do, in fact, suck. But what are we gonna do about it? I mean, can we really just walk around and say people suck, and then just, like, throw our hands up in the air and go eat our foie gras?
Yeah, and the fact is that we can reach a lot of people. A lot of people are horrified when they found out. And it's those people we have to focus on. And when they find out and they start insisting on change, change can happen. We know positive social change has happened in the past, so we just have to hope that we can make it happen again. And the amazing thing is, the thing that makes it so likely that positive social change will happen here, is that it all comes together. There's also so many human harms caused by the viciousness that is perpetrated upon animals, that once people start thinking straight about it, there are a lot of reasons, aside from hoping for compassion on the part of people, that things have really got to change.
Speaking of change, let's switch gears and talk about some news, shall we?
Why not?
So, of course, it's important to remember the victories and the small steps forward for farm animals along the way. It keeps me afloat. It keeps me having hope. And it's really important to just constantly reassess the situation and say, well, what is happening for the better? That said, it's the new year. Hopefully by the time we publish this, it will still be the new year.
Probably be next year.
Probably. But let's talk a little bit about what happened in 2009 for farm animals, because there were some interesting steps forward, starting with anti-confinement. Of course, in 2008, we had the Prop 2 campaign victory, where the three of the most egregiously cruel confinement systems for farm animals were prospectively banned in the state of California. And those three confinement systems are battery cages for hens, gestation crates for pigs, and veal crates for cows. Those were prospectively banned in California. Sorry?
Well, veal crates for calves.
Veal crates for calves, yeah. Thank you for clarifying. And in 2009, two other states joined that bandwagon. Michigan was the very first state where the legislature prospectively banned these three confinement systems, all three of them. The other ones have been either done through a ballot measure. So this was the first legislature to speak up for that. And in Maine, veal crates and gestation crates were prospectively banned. And now, of course, this is an incremental step. It's a very small incremental step, but it is still a step. And I can tell you firsthand from working on the Prop 2 campaign in California, the amount of people who went vegan as a result of what they learned from our campaigning was just enormous. I mean, just putting these issues on the map, it allows for people to think of these issues of food in a whole new light. And of course, all the while promoting veganism and realizing that this is just placing farm animals on the map. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. These changes and are so tiny that it can be frustrating to think about them. But at the same time that they're tiny, they're unbelievably enormous, because the fact that there are so many animals suffering in these horrible systems, and even though the replacements for them certainly are not humane or the way we would want to see animals treated, the fact that there's just any change, the fact that the industry has been required to do anything for these animals. I mean, if you've been doing this for a while, you just know for a long while that the industry was just a blank wall, and there was just no way to make any kind of a crack in it. It just completely ignored the animal protection movement. And now I think these put a few little cracks in that wall, and it's our job to see that those cracks are made wider, and that hopefully they're made wide enough so that people will really be able to see through that wall into what's really happening to animals, and hopefully will change their behaviors.
Yeah, I agree. And also in California, There was a tail docking bill that was passed that was signed by Governor Terminator Schwarzenegger, and it was passed, and the cruel practice of tail docking was banned in the state of California.
I know that. I mean, it's, you know, it's just one of the many, many mutilations that farm animals go through in order to force them into these unnatural living conditions. We kind of mutilate the animals so that they can fit into the production systems that we've created. But the idea that cows would have their tails taken off, I mean, aside from the pain that must cause, and it's not just the pain when it happens, but residual pain, as in any amputation, there's the fact that cows use their tails to get rid of flies. It's just so wrong. I mean, they're an important part of how a cow lives. If you go up to Farm Sanctuary, you'll see that some of the cows that have been rescued have had their tails docked, and some haven't. And the ones that have, they can't get the flies off of themselves. It's just so sad.
The cows that have had their tail docked, obviously that was pre-rescue.
Yeah, of course.
I just wanted to clarify that. Yeah, it's just unbelievable. But, you know, on the more positive side, 2009 was a tremendous year for farm animals by way of the media. First and foremost, Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer really changed our movement. And I really think that this book has the potential to do for this decade what Peter Singer's Animal Liberation did for the 70s.
Yeah, I think it's a great book, and I think it's having an enormous impact. I hope it will continue to have an enormous impact. It's certainly a message people don't want to hear, and somehow this book seems to have gotten through to a lot of people. It's been reviewed almost everywhere. Some of the reviews have been snarky, in particular the review of in the New York Times. A lot of the reviews have been amazing, really, really indicating that people's eyes were opened. And just the fact that such a well-known writer has tackled this topic and is doing the talk shows and really did. He's a really good writer. I mean, a lot of the facts and figures in there are things that people who are listening to this probably already know. But I think the book is still very worth reading if you haven't, because his messaging is so good. And that's what we're all always seeking to do, is find way to bring our message. We all know what our message is, but how do we say it the best way to convey the truth, to make that revolutionary change.
And when you get the books, flip right to page 51, because that's the page that Marianne is on.
Yeah, my colleague David Wolfson and I wrote an article that was quoted, and I have to say that is one of the most exciting moments of my life when I opened the book and saw that.
Also in 2009, by way of the media, Martha Stewart. Martha Stewart featured vegan cupcakes on her show.
Yeah, Martha's not a vegan. I think her daughter is. But she's been doing a lot of good stuff. I mean, she did the fur thing. She denounced fur. And I think if she wasn't a total foodie and didn't have her whole career based around food, maybe she'd go even a little further. But she's definitely not a vegan, but she's had a lot of good stuff on her show.
Yeah, and she said, I remember she said that she was going to have a vegetarian Thanksgiving. And
she was going to her daughter's.
Well, right, and her daughter, of course, being a fabulous vegan. Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah, I do love her.
I love her, too, kind of in an inappropriate way.
I know these. What about these lesbian vegan talk show hosts?
Or podcast show hosts.
Yeah, they're a great group.
Yeah, no, Ellen, of course, has just done absolutely tremendous things this past year. She has a section of her website dedicated to talking about her veganism. She's had really amazing movers and shakers on her show, including Wayne Pacelli. And I believe she had Kathy Freston on her show talking
about Jonathan Safran Foer.
Right, she had Jonathan Safran Foer, so that's pretty cool. And you say these vegan lesbians, there's also Jane Velez Mitchell, right?
Yeah, Jane's great, and she's reaching like such a great demographic, and she's so, like, she's just so straightforward. I love the way she talks. She just really tells it like it is.
We all love Jane. So today we have a very exciting interview for you. We're going to be interviewing a buddy of ours and a longtime activist, Stuart David, who, I don't know about you, but I think is pretty groovy. Yeah, Stuart is a really good thinker.
We are very happy to have with us today Stuart David. Stuart is an activist par excellence. He is well known in his local community of Asheville, North Carolina, and has had a significant impact there in improving laws pertaining to animals. In addition, he is an important contributor to a number of national animal advocacy organizations, has served on the board of Farm Sanctuary, and has done some very important work with PETA. He's also one of the clearest thinkers and calmest talkers I know of in the animal protection community, and a person we both turn to when we need to think out a thorny issue about animals. Hi, Stuart.
Well, hi, Jasmine. Thank you so much for having me.
One of the things that I know you think about a lot and which you've focused on in your activism is connections and disconnects between the animal protection community and the other burgeoning foodie movements, which I will collectively refer to here as the locavore movement. Could you share with us some of your insights about how those two communities fit together, or maybe they don't fit together?
Well, sure. I have a column that I know you've quoted a few times that I wrote called Greenwashed. It was in a local paper here over the summer. And what really got me started on it was I was reading that our local, we have a minor league baseball team down here in Asheville, the Asheville Tourists, and they were serving locally grown hot dogs. And then I did some more reading and I saw that actually the animals were actually transported to a processor up in Pennsylvania, and it was about a 1,400-mile round trip for the local animals to be taken and brought back. And I started thinking, I just kind of got a kick out of it. How can we call this local food if the animals are traveling that much? And then, of course, were they fed here? Were grains grown elsewhere? So I just started taking a really hard look at local foods and really. Unfortunately, when you talk about the foodie movements, when you talk about environmentalism, almost all of the focus has been on local foods. And I started, thinking about it. And I mean, all things being equal, sure, buying local is a good decision. But unfortunately, all things really aren't equal. And I started, reading about some research and just taking a really hard look at the local more movement, which we can talk about some more.
Wow, yeah. It's really amazing to me how people are just embracing this locavore movement and not looking beyond the surface at things like what you're talking about, like the feed and where that comes from, or even paying any attention to the animal cruelty issues.
Well, the cruelty issues are just really, glossed over so much. I mean, people, like to feel good and they use words like humane meat, which, we know is an oxymoron. I mean, certainly. Some procedures at factory farm. I mean, factory farms are egregious places, and smaller farms at times, do some, don't do some of the procedures. But I mean, anyone raising animals for food, their decisions revolve around the dollar. So, castrations, dehornings, brandings, etc., they're all done without anesthesia. I mean, you wouldn't, brand your dog without anesthesia. You wouldn't brand your dog, but certainly any painful procedure, you would go to a vet, I would hope, and use anesthesia. And I mean, most of the local animals wind up in commercial slaughterhouses that operate at breakneck speeds. And, the Humane Slaughter Act is not only not enforced, but it does not apply to birds, which is pretty crazy when birds are well over 90%, chickens and turkeys and ducks are well over 90% of the animals slaughtered, and yet it does not apply to them. So, I mean, the humane issues are pretty overwhelming and really not looked at hardly at all.
But even given all of these problems, isn't a primary focus of both movements the eradication of factory farming? At least in that area, can there be some mutuality, some working together? Oh, and just before you answer that question, could you give us just a brief overview of what you mean when you say factory farming?
Okay, up to probably estimated 99% of the animal products raised and sold in America come from factory farms, which are large industrial facilities. You can have 10,000 and more birds, chickens in a building. They are designed for economy, and they are designed about money, and animals are not given any consideration. Animals are food units. Chickens now are genetically modified so that they grow and are actually slaughtered at 6.5 weeks. That's pretty amazing to some people who have no idea that they're eating such young animals. Why are they killed at 6.5 weeks? Well, that's the perfect time for return on investment, because as animals grow, there's a certain point where they're not growing as fast, and it's time to kill them. And actually, these animals are full of antibiotics, and not because they're sick. I mean, they are sick, but not to treat injury. They are routinely given antibiotics because they're so sickly. You know, their hearts, their legs just can't handle this genetic manipulation where they grow so big. So they start dying really at five and a half weeks. But again, the perfect time to kill them for return on investment is to let some die and then, you know, slaughter them in about 6.5 weeks. So, you know, that's a glimpse into factory farming from pigs who never see the outside. They never see outside, you know, they never see daylight until the day they're put into a truck and taken from a factory farm to a slaughterhouse at 6 months of age. So, you know, that's a glimpse into factory farming. There are different levels. You know, there's free, quote-unquote, free-range farms, which are really factory farms, too. I mean, the legal definition of free-range really means, you know, access to the outdoors. It doesn't mean there's enough room for the animals to get outdoors. You can have 10,000 birds in a building and a little trap door going outside and call it free-range. So, you know, there's different levels of factory farming. But in all cases, animals are food units. They're not, you know, considered feeling, sentient beings, and profits are maximized.
But for those locavore or quote-unquote humane meat operations, which really aren't factory farms, even though there are, as you pointed out, very serious humane concerns, can there be some common ground?
Well, I think, you know, I wish there was more common ground. I mean, unfortunately to me, you know, since we're looking at this small 1% of food coming from this area, and I just don't see it really able to grow because, you know, there are some efficiencies of factory farming. I mean, these smaller farms are very land intensive. The animals grow slower, burn more calories, etc. So I do understand, you know, the idea of us moving back to a smaller family farm model. Unfortunately, since I've been on this earth, you know, the U.S. population's gone from 150 million to over 300 million, and world population's gone from 2 billion to almost 7. So as we have more and more mouths to feed, you know, I think that the old model doesn't work too well. Now, you know, again, people that are doing this are well-intentioned. I certainly don't have any gripe with them. But I think it kind of, you know, creates this loophole where people say, okay, well, meat could come from this way and could be raised this way, so therefore I'm going to keep eating it. But I challenge these people, if they really believe it, to do two things. To one, eat only animal products from, you know, raised this way. And, you know, it's very, very hard to do. The availability is very hard. And therefore, what they should do is reduce their consumption to an appropriate level where everyone could eat those products, which would mean they should drop their animal product consumption to about 1% of what they eat now, which means maybe Christmas, New Year, and a couple other holidays, you know, would be an appropriate response. I think the locavore movement should be shouting about eating less meat, yet they often send the message, you know, maybe inadvertently, but they send the message that, well, we can eat all the meat we want as long as this is the meat we buy. And it sets up kind of an elitist thing here of, you know, it's elite meat. It's something that a few people have access to. And I guess, in a sense, then they're saying that everyone else should be vegetarian. So I don't really see that as a global approach.
So the meat industrial complex, their factory farmers, frequently say that the locavore and the organic movements are out of touch because you can't feed the world that way. You actually agree with them.
It's the only way I agree with the factory farmers, but they're missing a step. I mean, they're saying if we won't, you know, it can't work if everyone's going to eat meat like that, and I agree with them. And the answer is that everyone needs to stop eating meat. I mean, when you look at the resources that go into an animal, you know, you can use up to 15 pounds of grain to produce a pound of flesh. I mean, it's just, it's wasteful, and it's more wasteful. It's just a ridiculous, you know, way to feed people, and all of these grains could be fed directly to people. I've been a vegan for 20 years. It's done wonders for my health, and I think, you know, people could really make this change. So, yeah, I do agree with the industrial agriculture in that one regard. We can't do a locavore. We can't use the locavores to feed everyone meat, but certainly we could close down the factory farms tomorrow, and we'd all be a lot better, and a lot of starving people would have more access to food.
So where do you come up with this stuff, Stuart? Are you just theorizing it? Are you finding studies? Where do you come up with your data?
Yeah, as I mentioned, you know, I started digging into local foods, and I came across a study that really should have been, you know, front page everywhere, but I had never heard of it before, and it was done by researchers at Carnegie Mellon University, and the title of it, and anyone can find it on the web, is Food Miles and the Relative Climate Impacts of Food Choices in the United States. That's a mouthful. It's Food Miles and the Relative Climate Impacts of Food Choices in the U.S. And they found, you know, the greenhouse gas emissions are really in the, you know, predominantly in the production phase of food, and they came up with this incredible statistic that final delivery of food from producer to retailer contributes only 4% of the greenhouse gases. And, you know, it's pretty amazing because, you know, it's almost counterintuitive until you really understand what goes into making food. Because, you know, you think, well, average food travels 1,500 miles, and of course it's a no-brainer if everything's equal to just buy your food locally. But again, everything's not equal when you're talking about animal products. So of course local's a good thing, and you know, people try and characterize me sometimes as anti-local, and that's silly. I'm very pro-local. But I mean, science is science, and what this study told us, that if you eat an all-local diet, you save the greenhouse gas equivalent of driving 1,000 few miles a year. But if you eat a vegetarian diet one day a week, it's the equivalent of driving 1,160 fewer miles a year. Vegetarian one day a week is better than local every day as far as greenhouse gases. And that's just an amazing statistic that you never hear about. I mean, you know, there's a great new book out by Dr. James McWilliams called Just Food. And I saw a quote from him, which did not make him any friends in the locavore movement, but again, science is science. And Dr. McWilliams said, if you want to make a statement, you should ride your bike to the farmer's market. But if you want to reduce greenhouse gases, you should become a vegetarian. So again, sometimes it seems counterintuitive, but that's because animal agriculture is so out of sight and out of mind. People just don't realize the intense use of resources to put that meat on their plate.
So that 4% figure, that means that only 4% of the greenhouse gases emitted by food, the entire food sector, only 4% is from transportation?
Yeah, only 4% final delivery. Now, there's other in different stages, but you know, there's more. I think it was 11% overall, but final delivery from producer to consumer is only 4%.
Yeah, that's an amazing figure.
Yeah, it really is. You know, because again, it feels good to buy local. And again, I'm not anti-local. There's a lot of great reasons to buy local. You get fresher food. You keep money in your community. You preserve farmland. I mean, there's lots of great reasons to buy local. I'm a big fan of local food. Of course, I'm a big fan of local vegan food. I don't buy animal products, so I'm not going to support local animal agriculture myself. But, you know, there's just so much that we don't hear about. I mean, I think animal agriculture and how it affects the environment and climate change is probably the most underreported story of the last decade. And I think, you know, the reasons are that, you know, people don't want to hear it, they don't want to change, and we have some very, very powerful moneyed industries that don't want the message to get out there.
Do you think this is going to change, Stuart?
Well, it's definitely changing some. I mean, you know, if you talk about, you know, Al Gore's book, his movie Inconvenient Truth, he left out the inconvenient truth about eating meat, but, you know, he's finally recognized it and talking about it, and, you know, the word is finally getting out there. I think, you know, we have to take a look at the many, many reasons to change our lifestyles. I mean, being an environmentalist is about consuming less. It's not just, you know, trying to get everything you usually get from a different source, but it's about consuming less. And there's, you know, the animal product diet is just the standard American diet, the acronym SAD, because it's a very sad diet. It's just incredibly wasteful and unhealthy. So I think we really have, you know, we're really going to see a lot more in the next decade, but, you know, we are up against a lot of people that make a lot of money off of, you know, they're not being changed. So it's going to be a struggle, but we're hearing more and more about it.
I hope you're right, Stuart. I think you are. One thing that's so important to keep in mind is that, yeah, it's true, a lot of people are making money off of the way things are right now. But no matter which way it goes, a lot of people are going to be making money. People have to eat, and somebody will be feeding them, and hopefully it will be the good guys feeding them and the good guys making some money.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an article in Forbes magazine of all places, and people can find this if they Google it. They just have to Google Forbes and drop that burger. And it's about a biochemist who is world-renowned at Stanford, who has decided that, you know, he wants his next focus to be eliminating animal agriculture on the planet because of climate change issues. And here's, you know, and what he wants to do is work with all the major companies, now the big companies, and show them that, you know, they'd be better off embracing plant-based agriculture. And, you know, a veggie burger should cost a lot less than a hamburger. It's only because of subsidies and you know, quantities, etc., that make it the other way around. And the day you can walk into a fast food joint and get a delicious, you know, bean-based or tofu-based or whatever veggie burger for half the price of a quarter pounder, I think will be a day that we're going to see a lot of people start making, you know, we're going to see a lot of headway, and we're going to hear a lot more about it. You know, it's healthier for us. It's less wasteful, shares food for other people. I mean, it's just such a win-win situation.
Well, Stuart, thank you so much for joining us in our hen house. As always, your wisdom is much appreciated, and we look forward to having you back here very soon. I love Stuart.
He is the best.
So, speaking of the best, we've had some interesting meals recently.
We have. We've been focusing on some mock meat.
I will leave out the unfortunate incident where we walked 27 blocks or so to go to Chipotle, which is currently having a test version of a Gardein brand burrito, only to find that Chipotle was closed. I won't talk about that.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that either, but it is something you can look forward to a review of in a future podcast.
But speaking of Gardein, last night for dinner we had Gardein, which, by the way, is sold at our regular grocery store, not our health food store, in the tofu section. And the night prior, we had another type of mock meat called match meat. So we're going to talk very briefly about our feelings about match meat and our feelings about Gardein. So which was it? Which took your heart? Match or Gardein?
Well, they're different, and they serve different purposes. And for people who are not very good cooks, in which category I would include myself.
And myself.
The Gardein is definite. I mean, it's all done. It has a delicious sauce on it. And the texture is really, really good. I would say the match, texture is not as good, and you have to actually cook it. I mean, and dress it up and make it taste good. It's meant to be put into recipes. So they do serve somewhat different purposes. For our purposes, I would have to say Gardein was the winner.
And I have to agree with you there about Gardein, but I do want to say something interesting about Match and something I really admire about Match. First of all, you buy Match in the meat section of your grocery store. I'll get back of D'Agostino's sells it here in New York. And it's sold as if it were meat. Like, it has the styrofoam bottom and the saran wrap top, and it's pliable like dead animals, except for it is not oppressed. And I actually think it's really kind of cool that they sell that in the grocery store in the meat section. But I am not a popular person for thinking that, because a lot of people who have been exposed to match meats feel as though they shouldn't be subjected to going into the meat section of their grocery store, and it should be in the health food section of their grocery store. I couldn't disagree more. I actually think it's not us who need to be eating the mock meat in the first place. It's my Kansas living meat eating brother, Jeremy, and it's your Kansas living meat eating brother, or your hypothetical Kansas loving living meat eating brother whose name might be Jeremy or might not be. What do you think?
Yeah, I have to agree. I think we're agreeing all too much during this podcast, but I don't really care whether vegans are happy getting this in the meat section. I mean, I love vegans and they're my favorite people in the world, but what I want is to change other people, and I think that they're most likely to change by being able to find this product in the meat section. So I would have to vote yeah on keeping it in the meat section. Good move, match meat.
Well, I don't know about you, but I need a cocktail. It's been fun. I had a fun time recording our very first episode of Our Hen House. Did you have fun?
It was fun, even for a shy person like me.
You're painfully shy. Thank you so much for joining us for our very first podcast episode of Our Hen House. Please go to ourhenhouse.com, email us at ourhenhouse@gmail.com. Let us know your thoughts, your feelings, your innermost secrets, whatever. Your secrets are safe with us. Thank you so much for joining us. Please join us next time for Our Hen House. Until then, go vegan, damn it.